Welcome to the She Runs Trails podcast. I am your host, Elements of Daisy. I am an ultra runner and endurance mindset coach. If you're new here, hello there. In this podcast, I interview other female trail runners in hopes to educate, empower, and inspire more women to run on the trails. If you're a returning listener and have been enjoying the podcast, it would really mean a lot to me if you can rate and leave a review in whichever platform you're listening to this episode. If you would like to support the podcast and help it keep it ad-free, please consider donating as low as a dollar to the podcast. You can donate through the Anchor account. The link is in the show notes. This will really help me. Thank you so much for your support. Let's get into the show. Today we have Shante Salibert, and I'm really excited to talk to her today. She is a trail runner, an avid hiker, a backpacker, and many of you probably know her through as her writing. She is a writer. She actually wrote this book, The Hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, the Southern Californian section. So today we are going to be talking a lot about the PCT. I got my Leona Divide shirt to represent the PCT. Her work has also been in modernhiker.com. Many of you guys know that website, through the REI Op Journal, Adventure Journal, like many outdoor articles and magazines. So you probably are very familiar with what she has written. She's a great writer. And I'm excited today to talk about her transition from, you know, how she started trail running. She still backpacks and hikes, but she now has incorporated trail running. And now being an avid hiker and backpacker, how trail running has been for her. So we're going to talk about that today. So without further ado, let's bring her on.
Okay.
Hi, Daisy. It's so good to see you.
Likewise. I know we saw each other a few months ago at the Run With Us in Pasadena event. So I'm glad that it hasn't been so long since we last saw each other.
Right. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm so excited to talk about everything that you just mentioned and excited to talk with you. So thanks.
Yeah. Thank you for joining me today. So tell us, how did you get into trail running?
It's interesting because I got into trail running, honestly, to do something positive for my mental health. I had gone through a pretty dark period a couple of years ago where my uncle died, and he was basically like my dad growing up. So he died after a really quick and aggressive stint with cancer. And then not too long after that, I actually lost two friends who decided to take their own lives within a couple of weeks of each other. So it was just a very, very dark time. And I was struggling. Like, hiking is usually sort of my method of dealing with things when they get rough. And it wasn't enough. I mean, I went and talked to therapists. And one day I was talking to one of my editors, actually, Hillary Oliver from Outdoor Research. And I said to her, I'm like, you know, Hillary, I think I need something to work towards. Like, I need a goal of some sort. I need to know, you know, just something to put in the future that I can get excited about. And usually I do that maybe with like backpacking trips. And she said, well, do you want to come run the Teton Crest Trail with my friend and I at the end of summer? I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. I was like, wait, run the Teton Crest Trail? Teton Crest Trail, for folks who don't know, is quite a lengthy trail. I can't remember right now the mileage. I want to say it's, 48 miles or something like that, somewhere in that neighborhood. And it's in the Tetons in, you know, up yonder. And I was like, well, hey, Hillary, I don't actually run. And she's like, you know what, trail running really is power walking up the hills and then enjoying the flats and the downhills. And I said, well, maybe I could do that. And I don't know what about that whole conversation got under my skin, but I thought, like, I don't know, I'll just go to Griffith Park and I'll see if running on dirt feels nice. And, you know, it didn't, because I hadn't run in a long time. Like, I played soccer when I was a kid and played tennis, and I tried, like, I ran a 5K once years ago. I was like, oh man, I don't know if my body's built for this. And I downloaded like a couch to 5K program and kept working my way up. We didn't end up running the Teton Crest Trail that summer, but by the end of summer, I had run 13 miles in the Cottonwood Lakes Basin up in the Sierra, which I never would have thought that I'd do. And honestly, after that, like first 4 or 5 months of trail running, I was hooked. I have done it ever since.
Did you feel any trend, like hiking, you know, you're backpacking, carrying a heavy pack, and now when you're trail running, you're carrying, did you feel like going up the climbs were easier for you?
Yeah, for sure. It's funny because one thing that Hillary said to me when we were talking about this is she's like, just so you know, this will probably ruin you for backpacking. She's like, it's so different moving on the land this way. And I agree. Like it, I think that's what really struck me about it is I love backpacking. I just went backpacking 2 weekends ago in the Sierra. Mm-hmm. I've got another trip in another 2 weeks. But the trail running, feeling a little lighter. I mean, I still carried the kitchen sink when I did that Cottonwood Lakes run because I was so nervous. I'd never, you know, I'm so used to carrying a big backpack up in the mountains. So, but just that feeling of, I felt so much more a part of the land when I was running. I felt sort of like an animal. I felt just connected on this deeper level. And yeah, that lightness was so fascinating. And now I love going to different places. Like I was just up in the Columbia River Gorge for a friend's wedding, Casey from Modern Hiker's wedding, actually. And I ran, you know, when I was up there, because now that's the thing I do. And it's just a way to connect with the land when I go to different places. And I love it. And I do. I love that feeling of lightness and of sort of moving, you know, even though the hills are still, you know, running uphill is not always my favorite thing, but it's still that feeling of accomplishment when you get to the top.
When was this when you started trail running? Like how long ago was this?
It was before the pandemic. I want to say it was 2019. So maybe that's spring.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of people are kind of saying like, oh, I'm too old. I can't, you know, I'm in my late 30s. I can't start trail running now. And I tell people, man, it, like, you see ultra runners in their 60s running. Like,
Dude, I was 40. I was 40 when I started trail running. So it's, you know, nobody ever believes me when I say that's my age. But, you know, so now I'm 44. And it's funny because I remember, like, I think it was my mom who asked, she's like, isn't that going to be bad for your joints? And I actually got diagnosed with arthritis a couple of years ago, and I've got it in my feet and I have it in my neck. And my doctor was like, no, keep doing all of this stuff, you know, switch your shoes. So I switched to Hokas, but he's like, switch your shoes, but keep doing it. It's good for your joints. It's good for your body. You know, that whole idea of running being this like horrible thing for people who are, you know, older, it's going to hurt your joints. It's a lie. I mean, it's not true. I think, you know, you have to know your body and, you know, consult with your doctor and everything, but for me, it was the complete opposite feeling. It was a feeling of joy, of feeling the best in my body that I've probably ever felt.
Yeah, I always tell people, it's like running down the hill is not bad for your knees. Batting down the hill with bad form is bad for your knees. Like you gotta make sure you're, you know, wrong shoes, wrong form, that could really destroy your body. So make sure you have the right gear, right form and everything. So what was your relationship before trail running? Did you try road running? How was that? Like when you were, how was that relationship for you?
Non-existent. I tried, you know, I tried road running probably 10 years ago. A friend of mine, maybe it was longer actually, but a friend of mine was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I had this feeling of helplessness, like, oh my gosh, why? There's nothing I could do for her. Like the doctors have to do things for her. What can I do for her? And I ended up running the Susan G. Komen, you know, 5K in downtown LA. And I remember training for it and going out with a friend who agreed to be my training buddy. And I remember the first day we ran the full mile and ran it straight through. And I was like, oh, I just ran a mile. And it's funny to think of it now because it seems like nothing to me. But I remember like, okay, I guess I could do this. But I will run in cities, like on streets, on sidewalks when I'm traveling. But it's not my favorite thing. So after that 5K, I didn't really do it anymore because it wasn't super inspiring to me, honestly. Like I love walking around cities, but for some reason I don't love running around them. Although I'm probably going to go run around Copenhagen when I go to Denmark at the end of the month. So maybe I take that back. Maybe internationally, I like running in cities.
Maybe to explore, quick way to get through the city and explore the city. Yeah. So, I guess what I'm trying to get to is like, if someone has a bad experience with road running and they don't want to give trail running a chance because they don't like road running, maybe they should try it because it's a whole different experience, right? Like, what do you like about trail running? What's like something you really enjoyed about trail running?
Well, it goes back to that feeling I was talking about earlier of just feeling like I'm part of the land, you know, feeling like this little animal out there moving freely. it brought back a lot of the feelings I have when I'm backpacking, and I can't go backpacking all the time. I mean, you know, I've got work that I do, I've got to keep the roof over my head and all that. But the feeling of trail running brought up so many of those feelings of backpacking for me, of being really hyper-focused and in the moment, almost like I talk about backpacking as being walking meditation. Mm-hmm. And trail running gave me that same feeling. I was so surprised. I mean, I'm really hyper-focused because I don't want to trip on things. I don't want to fall, which, you know, you do. I've done it. It's fine. Once you do it, you get over it. But it really gave me that feeling. And so, you know, running in the city, like I said, when I'm traveling somewhere new, that can be kind of a cool way to see a place. But there's something about trail running that I'm so immersed in the environment that it seems like I'm on vacation when I trail run, even though I go before work. And, you know, it's just such a beautiful experience. Like I always come away from a run being glad that I did it, even if I got up super early, just that feeling of gratitude, like I get to do this. How lucky am I?
And when you started trail running, like, you know, the fear is like, oh, I'm slow. I can't run all the time. What helped you kind of build momentum? Because you signed up for your races after that. Like, what gave you the courage to just keep showing up? And then how did you build your momentum?
Well, it's funny. Like, one of the people I talked to early on is a guy named Brendan Leonard. And a lot of people know him from his website, Semi-Rad, and all the books he's written a ton of books. He writes a lot about writing. And we had a conversation once because he had run, I think he had just started running, ultras, like 100-mile races. And I was like, oh my gosh, how do you even do this? Because for me, it's like, there's no way I'm ever going to get to that point. And he's like, well, the first mistake I made when I signed up for an ultra was I signed up for a completely flat race, thinking like that would be the easiest thing. And he's like, I realize you have to incorporate some hills in there. That way you can walk the hills. Now, of course, you can walk at any time. You walk when you want, you do you. But there was something interesting about that. Cause I was like, ooh, he just gave me permission and to sort of just make the experience what I wanted it to be. And it sort of helped me drop any notions of, oh, I've got to compete with people on Strava, or I have to run a certain pace to be a real runner, or, you know, oh my gosh, if I'm not running these like sketchy single tracks in the middle of nowhere, I'm not, you know, a real trail runner. Like, I realized that all this stuff is made up. It's just all stuff that we create to sort of categorize the world. And sometimes we fall into that trap of letting those categories define us. And so once I was able to sort of drop that and focus on the feelings of running and what it did for me in like inside, I mean, outside has definitely benefited, but inside, that was the change for me that I realized, like, man, just go out there and be, just exist and enjoy it. It does not matter what anybody else thinks.
So setting no expectations besides just getting out the door. That's the only expectation.
And coming back through the door.
And coming back.
I do want to get home every time.
And what was your first trail race?
My first, well, it's funny because I signed up for trail races in 2020. Oh. You know what happened then. I signed up for a half marathon in 2020 that got canceled, just like everything else. And it was a Solomon women's half up in, I want to say in Sonoma. Mm-hmm. Signed up with my friend Severia and some other folks. And that got canceled, but they did it virtual. So I said, well, I've been training this whole time. And that was one of the things that helped keep my head on straight during especially those first few months of the pandemic. So it's like, well, I'm just going to do it anyway. So during the time of when that first race was scheduled, like you had a certain week or something or weekend you can complete it in. It was during all of the uprisings that summer and, you know, which I was active in. And I went that Saturday morning to go run in Griffith Park. I'd mapped out my 13 miles, my, you know, like exactly what I was going to do. And they had closed the park because the uprisings in LA were very active and they had some excuse like, well, we don't want that in the park. You know, ridiculous, but I had to sort of, I was committed to doing this run. I'm like, all right, I'm doing this run. I have so much in my mind right now, like all of us, I need this run. And so I ended up going to Pasadena, running in the Arroyo, ran all the way up to the foothills, ran back, and my knees hurt at the end of it. But I remember looking at my watch and like, holy cow, I did it. Like there was no finish line. There were no timers. There were no little half bananas. I just did it on my own. So technically that was my first one. But then this past year, I was like, oh man, they're starting to do races again. I should finally sign up for like an official race. So I signed up for the Valencia Trail Half. I signed up for it just because of when it was. Like I needed, it's like, oh, March is a good time for me. I have enough time to train again. Didn't look at the elevation profile. So I've learned a lot since then. You should look at the elevation profile because that race was like, pa-choo, 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 pa-choo. And it ended up being some, you know, nutty heat wave in March. And it was, I was so glad that I got to start like right before the sun came up. But yeah, that was technically my first, you know, real trail race.
So let's talk a little bit about Valencia. So you go here, you start, what was going through your mind as you're running your, you know, your first, you know, essentially official trail race? You're out here and it was a half marathon, right? It was 13, a little over 13 miles. Like you're climbing up. Did at any point where you're like, this is not fun, or at any point you were like, yeah, this is why I do this, or like, why am I here?
It's hilarious because I think my brain cycled through all versions of both of those statements the whole time. I remember lining up at the start line, and when I signed up, I was trying to get friends to do it with me. And most of my friends who are runners in LA are not trail runners, you know, or they don't want to run 13 miles. You know, they do a couple miles, that's their thing. So I was going solo, which was a little intimidating. And some of my friends had agreed to show up at the finish line, which just blew my mind to drive up from LA and do that for me and just to be there when I finished. So I kind of had them in the back of my mind, and every once in a while I'd text them or they'd text me, and it was like a little encouragement. But honestly, being out there, I was prepared. You know, I'd done the training. I was able to run the hills, even if it was really slow. And it ended up being like, at one point I kind of find it just got into the experience, and I was so, it was that hyper focus again, that presence, like a flow state, you know, where you are right there and you're not thinking about anything else other than getting up or down that hill. Maybe it's hot, maybe you're thirsty, but I was so in the moment, and I came away with it. I'd say right before I hit the finish line, I'm like, I'm never doing that again. And then I got to the finish line, I'm like, I can't wait to do it again. I'm definitely signing up for next year's.
And how has running evolved for you since then?
Well, now it's almost a daily part of my life. I try to run a couple of miles, you know, at least like probably I'd say 4 days a week, sometimes five, because I also mix in hiking and mm-hmm. stuff, backpacking trips. But it's just a part of who I am now, which is something I never thought I'd say. It's something that brings me joy. It's something that does help me work through difficult things in my life. It's a nice means of escape when life is really hectic. I know I can go bang out a few miles in the trails and then sit down on my computer for the day. You know, my body has changed certainly throughout the last few years of picking up this habit. And I think of it like that. It's sort of a practice. Mm-hmm. I do yoga and I've been trying to incorporate like weights and strength training, but it's the running is the thing. And I went home this summer to see my family in Wisconsin, and it was like 85-90% humidity, and I still ran because it's what I do now. And it's something I never thought that would be me. Like, I'm a runner. It still boggles my mind sometimes, but every single time I finish a run, I like thank my body. I'm so happy for it.
I think it's very beautiful that you said that the moment you kind of like removed expectations or that define of what a runner is or a trail runner, you know, like you kind of compare yourself to like an elite. You have to be running on these alpine mountains to be considered, you know, a mountain runner. And you remove, you know, the Strava comparison and everything and just became your own person. How running just now became part of you naturally. Like now you don't care about the miles or you don't care about like the data. You just kind of just go out and run. So you eliminate that pressure. Do you feel that makes it easier for you to get out the door, or do you still struggle days where you know that, oh man, I don't feel like running, but I know I should run because I never regret going for a run. Like, how's that now? Like your relationship with trail running?
Oh my gosh, it's so much easier to get out the door. Honestly, I think for a long time, because I really didn't know a lot about running, I thought every run you went out there and you were going like max. I was trying to hit my like 10 mile minutes, which, you know, for me as a person who wasn't a runner and who, you know, who's also just hadn't been taking care of herself for a hot minute. Like I thought, okay, I've got to go out there and hit this time and do this. And I was getting hurt. You know, I had knee pain and pulling my calf and, you know, just these little things. And then I'd have to stop running. And so once I made that transition of realizing like, oh dude, this can just be I don't have to overthink this. Just get out there and move. And I look forward to it. Like, I set my alarm at night now and I don't grimace when I do it. And going this weekend, it was hilarious because this wedding was Saturday and I got up Sunday morning and I went running and you know, it was a wedding. We were dancing, we were partying. And I walked back in and there was a brunch before everybody left Sunday. And Casey, one of the grooms, was like, you just went running? That's a hate crime this morning. I was like, no, dude, I don't know. I didn't even think about it. I just got up and went because I could. And there was this beautiful river there to run next to. And I also started doing heart rate training earlier this year, which you might have seen on my Strava. And that did take me a hot minute to sort of really let go of the expectations because you have to run so slow, or I do, to have my heart rate be in a, you know, not jacked up to here.
Yeah.
So I really had to lose the ego on that because I couldn't do the 10-minute miles anymore, or, you know, even at one point I had gotten under 10 and I was very excited about that. I was like, well, if I want to try to strengthen my heart, I'm going to try this thing and like really dig in and force myself to slow down. It is weird, but honestly, yeah, it makes it even more fun to go out because I'm really not thinking about anything other than like doing this nice thing for my body and my mind.
It's funny you say about the heart rate, because when I coach my athletes and I tell them you have to do easy effort, and then I just kind of tell them where their heart rate should be, and they're like, something's wrong with my heart rate because I was running slow. I think my heart rate monitor is not working because I was running slow. I was like, no, you probably weren't running slow.
Oh, yeah, I've been looking at my watch like, I don't think it's on tight enough.
Yeah, it's not working. I always recommend the heart rate, the chest strap, that's more accurate, but the watch is not like extremely inaccurate. Like, it's not like you're 180 and it should be 140, you know, it's not going to give you like that 40, you know, rate difference. So that's very important that you say, like, sometimes we think we're going slow, but we're really not going that slow, and then we're wondering why we're fatigued, why we're tired, and usually that's our body telling us, so you probably did a hard effort run. So let's talk about backpacking. How did you get into backpacking?
It's funny because I've always had this connection to the land. Like, growing up as a kid, I went to the Boys and Girls Club, and there was a Boys and Girls Club right across the street from my house. And they had a summer camp. And so I would go there, but we never did backpacking. It was camping or you stayed in the cabins at the camp. And I lived in like New York, I lived in South Carolina, and then I moved out here. And I remember once I saw Mount Whitney from the road and knew that that thing existed, I was like, what is that? Oh, that is a beautiful mountain range. The whole range, the Sierra, I think is really what got me into backpacking. Just that, just being curious about it. I mean, I think as a writer, a lot of what drives me or motivates me is that curiosity. It's the same thing in my relationships with people. And, you know, it was the same thing with backpacking. I was like, I want to be in there and I want to know what's in there. I'd look at a map and I want to know what the map looks like in real life. And, you know, in order to get to some of these places, they're not maybe close enough, at least for a day hike. Now, you could probably trail run them. I just saw you were up there, up in Doozy Basin and some places, but I was like, well, backpacking would be a cool way to get there. And so I had a friend, my friend Rebecca, who was also interested in backpacking. And, you know, we went up to Yosemite one weekend and a friend of hers was a ranger there. And so she took us backpacking and it was hilarious. She gave us very like limited guidance on what to bring. And so the two of us were like, we brought everything because we thought we were going to die out there. So we had like pillows, deodorant. We had a full pound of cinnamon bears. You know, we had full, like, giant pieces of fruit, and then one small bear canister, which was an issue when we were getting ready to go to bed. We had to eat a lot of that food before we went to bed. That was how I learned about bear canisters and how to pack the right amount of food. But yeah, but even through, like, all of the, you know, there was a bear that interrupted me when I was going to the bathroom on that first trip. And, you know, even the, like, things like that happened, I came away just wanting more because it, you know, like I talked about earlier, backpacking is this amazing way to sort of get really deep both into a place and with yourself. And I just found that that's one of my favorite ways to be. So it is my love.
What do you see now that when you bring friends or you see other, you know, backpackers getting into backpacking, what is like common mistakes that beginners, new packers do, and yourself, like you just mentioned right now, over more food than what the bear canister can carry or hold? And for those who do not know, when you're in the backcountry, you have to put your food in the bear canister or else the bear will come and get it in your tent and looking for it. So
yeah, well, it's something I talk about. So I taught for, I think, I don't know, maybe 6 years or something, a course here in Southern California called the Wilderness Travel Course. And it's a really cool thing that the Sierra Club does that teaches just a bunch of different skills. It's a 10-week class, and then the students go on two overnight trips that are mostly off trail, actually. So we teach them about navigation, and we do snow stuff with them. And this was actually the first year I didn't teach, so it was kind of weird. But one of the things that I always talked about was this idea of packing our fears, because especially, I'd say, especially as women, or, you know, if you're maybe a non-binary person, or, you know, gender non-conforming, there's a lot you worry about, you know, how others are going to perceive you out there. I think a lot of people worry about other people out there. So you worry about that. You worry about bears. You worry about lightning. You worry about mountain lions, the snow, ice, like everything possible if you've never done this before. And that's so normal. But I've seen people out there that carried like two of everything because they were so nervous to have something break down. And so I think that's one of the most common things. And then when your backpack gets to a certain point, you know, it gets super uncomfortable and you're like, man, this isn't fun. I don't want to do this again. So it's hitting that sweet spot of feeling like, okay, I'm prepared, but I'm not so prepared that I'm now uncomfortable. And what I tell people is like the way to combat that is just totally deciding what kind of thing, like shoring up your knowledge base. So for me, I took, you know, wilderness first aid. I took WTC as a student before I ever taught it. Going with other people, like having mentors, if you can, people who know, or going with groups of people and learning from your mistakes or from their mistakes, and sort of helping yourself feel more prepared, just like anything, is one of the ways I think people can sort of combat that. Because you don't have to go ultralight to go into the mountains, but it is good to maybe not bring, you know, 60 pounds of stuff in the summer. So,
and because I've heard that ultralight, so the ultralight, the sacrifice is comfort. So the less you bring, the more discomfort you'll feel out on the trail. But when you're actually moving, you'll feel more comfortable. But when you're like sleeping wise, you might not have a nicer sleep setup or something like that.
It depends. I mean, there's so many advances that have been made in ultralight gear. I'd say at this point, my kit is fairly ultralight. It's not like I went backpacking a couple weekends ago up to Hilton Creek Lakes, and you know, it was myself and two other friends, one of whom's also a trail runner, and like, he had his little fast pack, and my other friend had basically a fast pack, and I had like a fast pack on steroids. And you know, but we played Sushi Go, we played Farkle, we had wine, or we had beer with us, I think. And you know, there's a lot of different things that you can trade off. And I only went lighter with my gear once I really got into it and knew this is something I want to do. And as I've gotten older, it's been so much better to have, you know, lighter gear. But, you know, I definitely wouldn't tell people like, you must start with, you know, the lightest gear. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you can't do this. You know, that's the same. Sorry, I just saw Gus Badwater. Did anyone have a slow pack? Yeah, that's how I used to backpack. Real slow pack. That was my vibe.
Well, I'm a true believer. I've done backpacking. I've had three times I've done it, very bad experience. So I literally sold my backpacking, the last backpacking event. I was like, I'm not backpacking anymore. But I'm very interested in fast packing, which is a combination between trail running and backpacking. Like I want to do like the Tahoe Rim Trail and JMT and High Sierra. Like I have these big aspirations. So, and we have a question here about enduring pain in an ultra, but I think it's very similar in backpacking. So you're out there for multiple days, and what do you use to get through when you're having those tough moments out in the backcountry after multiple days being out there, something unexpectedly happens. And you can tell us a story or a moment where you're just like, you didn't know how you're going to get out of it.
Sure. I mean, it's very common. Like when I was out on the PCT for a couple months, not every day is going to be all puppies and roses. It's a lot of days you're going to be like, why am I doing this? And when I was out there, I was also writing a book, so I kind of had to stay. But you get those days where, you know, maybe your body hurts or you're tired or you're just over it. And you're like, man, I remember at one point I started having just constant dreams about wearing a black dress. It was like a black dress and lipstick. It was so weird. And it was so specific, that and enchiladas. But, you know, one of the things that's kind of a maxim in the backpacking world is you don't quit on a bad day. You know, sit it through, find yourself somewhere, maybe stop hiking early that day or stop running if you're doing an ultra, and just sit there for a hot minute and let your brain and body come down from that stress, because your stress levels are probably like way up here, your cortisol, you know, your hormones and everything. Like, let it all come down a bit and take stock of everything, because chances are you'd probably still rather be where you are than sitting at home or sitting at your job or something like that. You know, it's a gift to be able to be out there. And when you can sort of reframe your brain and get back into that space, even on those tough days, like there were days on the Colorado Trail where, oh my God, it was like monsoon and hail. The hail out there is nuts. So it's like constant hail. I had like a cow's charge me, which is weird, moose, you know, so many things. And there were a lot of days where I was like, this is not fun. This is not what I signed up for. But I would pause and take a break, eat something. Usually it's like your energy might be a little depleted. I was like, eating something is really underrated, I think. And then you're kind of like, okay, I can do this. I can do hard things. I think back too to a lot of the other hard things that I've endured in life. It's like, you know, whether it's things that I chose, like I climbed Kilimanjaro. I think about that a lot. Or just rough things that have happened that I just had to get through. I think about that when I'm having bad days out there, and it keeps me, or bad miles, you know, and it keeps you going. Like, I've definitely had runs, longer runs, where I wish I could quit, but I'm in the middle of nowhere and I just kind of keep going. So I need to sit down in this log, have a snack, calm my buns down, drink some water, and reconfigure my brain. So
yeah, I think that sometimes food or even taking a nap, and for ultras, when you start getting those 50, 100, maybe not the 50, but like the 100 milers, sometimes taking that 5-minute nap or closing your eyes for 2 minutes will such recharge, right? Like a little quick, just like you said, bring your mind back down, like eat some calories. Sometimes you may just, your body's just in survival mode. So it's like giving you all these signals and it's wanting you to quit. It's telling you, what the heck are you doing right now? No, stop. Like, this is not safe for your body right now. Like, get out. So I again, like I said, I really believe backpacking and ultra running is so similar. And I think that I really think backpackers will make great ultra runners. I have a friend who he through hiked the PCT and he's getting into ultra running, and we went running together, and he's hiking, like I'm jogging up the hill and he's just walking up the hill. And I'm just like, your hiking pace is my jogging pace. Like, you don't realize that. And every time, like even when I went to Bishop Pass, the backpackers just pass, they have big packs, but they pass me with their big packs up the hill. Because you guys know how to climb. I don't know.
It's so true. I hike the hills when I do hilly stuff, especially in the Sierra. I don't even bother trying to run it because I know I can hike it faster.
Yeah, and you can hike it faster than running. It's like, I think backpackers have learned to be efficient climbers, per se. Mm-hmm. So you talk about, you were writing a book. Am I saying, was it the PCT book?
That was the book.
This was the book. So you wrote a book about the Southern California section of the PCT. I'm curious to know, so how did you go about starting to write the book, and then what was the logistics? Because you didn't through hike from Campbell, you didn't do the whole thing at once, right? You did it like in sections.
Yeah, I had a day job. It was like, the crazy thing about that book, like the cool thing is that a friend, Casey from Modern Hiker, actually referred me to this publisher, and they reached out to me because they, not because they saw, you know, my writing on Modern Hiker or whatever, they reached out to me because they saw a blog that my friend Brooke and I did. We did a project that we called Year of the Scout. She found a 1947 Girl Scout handbook and brought it over to my house one day, and we started flipping through it, and we're like, man, this is going to be really sexist, and let's see what they were having, you know, learn how to iron your shirts. No, it was like, learn how to sharpen your axe and learn how to cut a hole in the ice to rescue somebody. And we're like, what? And we realized, we're like, oh man, this is in the post-war years when, you know, you just got done having Rosie the Riveter and women stepping up to do things they hadn't been doing. So that translated to the Girl Scouts. And so, so basically we did this project for a year where we would pick badges out of a hat. There were 100 in the book. We'd pick one every month and try to earn it. And it was tough. So we blogged this, but we just did it for us. We did it for our friends. And then we basically, you know, would blog about this. And this publisher saw my Girl Scout blog and said, oh, maybe you'd like to write this book. And I already had a relationship with the PCT. My friend Colby had just hiked it the year before. And I had always hiked sections here in Southern and Central California. Always dreamed of doing more, but never thought I'd have the time. And it was such a gift when they reached out to me. And so I told my boss, I was like, hey, I got this book deal and I'm going to go need to go backpack a bit. And I ended up eventually going full time freelance because I realized it was a really amazing opportunity to pursue this dream of being a freelance writer and writing about the outdoors. And so, yeah, when I was working on the book, a lot of it was done in long weekends with friends, and we'd set up shuttles and do these sections and do, like, you know, long days so that we could cover a lot of ground. And then I did take a 2-month sabbatical and did, you know, kind of the San Bernardinos up through the Sierra and just slow boated the whole thing. Was documenting like every plant I saw and, you know, rock and taking side trails and side trips, going to trail towns. It was honestly the best summer of my life.
And how did you go about getting the permits? Did you still apply, like, just any other, like, how the regular through hikers, do you apply for the permit for the season? Because as long as you, how did it work for you?
Yeah, I did for that because I was doing, you can apply for a long distance PCT permit if you're doing over 500 miles or like 500 mm-hmm. miles or over. And so I did for that summer I was. And so I applied. And since it was kind of out of the normal starting window, normally people are starting, you know, March, April. Because I was starting further up and I was starting in, you know, June, I guess, it wasn't that difficult to, you know, get the permit. But yeah. But anybody who wants to do, you know, wants to get out there and do the whole shebang, it is a little competitive, especially now, you know, there's books out there. There's these movies you may have heard of, like Wild and Mile and a Half, Walk in the Woods, that all popularize this idea of getting out there. And a lot of people sort of look down on those books. And I think that however people get to these experiences and get to this connection with the outdoors and with the land is okay. You know, it doesn't, you know, not everybody's going to like Wild, but there's going to be people that saw themselves in that and said, hey, you know, I never considered doing something with my body could also help my mind. So if that opens people up to those experiences or opens them up to seeing the outdoors in a different way, I think that's awesome.
And for those who do not know what the PCT, just a brief definition, I forgot to bring that before I asked the question, but yeah, just want to share for those that do not know what the PCT, just give us like a brief definition of the PCT.
Sure. The PCT is the Pacific Crest Trail. It is one of the National Scenic Recreation Trails in the United States, kind of like the Appalachian Trail or the Continental Divide. Those three together are known as the Triple Crown. It's 2,650 miles, give or take. It really depends on sort of the year, because contrary to popular belief, the whole PCT is not actually protected. So there are segments that run through private land, and there's an easement that allows you just to hike the trail through those segments. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of an ongoing project for the Pacific Crest Trail Association, which is the nonprofit that sort of manages the trail and manages the permitting system. But yeah, it's an amazing trail. It was conceived a long time ago, actually, by a woman, which a lot of people also don't know, who wondered about sort of connecting the whole Western, you know, West Coast via the mountains. And yeah, so the route stays high most of the time. There's a complete misconception that the first 700 miles is just the desert and it's broiling and you're going to die because a rattlesnake ate you or something. And the first 700 miles also has something like 6 or 7 mountain ranges. So, you know, it's a misnomer. And there's snow in those ranges starting like 48 miles in at Mount Laguna. So it's quite the terrain and the, you know, geology of it all is just much more diverse than people probably give it credit for. But you still to this day hear hikers talking about, oh, we got through the first 700 miles of the desert. Now we're in the mountains. And I'm like, you went through mountains too.
How long is the SoCal section? So the from Campo to Tulum Meadows, like how long was that?
Yeah, so Tuolumne Meadows is the top bit of it. And so that whole segment, which is technically SoCal and Central California, but my editors were like, yeah, no. It's 942.5 miles, so just under 1,000.
Wow. Yeah. So yeah. So you would need a permit because it'll be more than 500. So once you do just like California, pretty much, and that it's right above the Sierra, right? Like it's just right above the Sierra.
Yeah, it's in the Tuolumne Meadows is still deep in the Sierra. It's part of Yosemite National Park. It's just kind
Okay.
of more north in the park. It's where there's a lot of cool, like Lambert Dome, and I'm trying Cathedral Lakes is something people might know up there. It's where the mobile station and Lee Vining, it's kind of just west of there.
Were you
Monolith.
surprised not seeing a lot of like besides the traditional hike like backpackers, like hikers or runners on the PCT? Like here, like the Southern California, like
Oh, yeah.
below like Lancaster area, like from pretty much this whole like San Gabriel Mountains, San Bernardino Mountains. Were you surprised of how like not popular it is?
It's wild to me. There's like, besides the most popular trailheads like Mount Baden-Powell and things like that are on the PCT, Eagle Rock down at, by Warner Springs, so much of it is a ghost town. It is absolutely nuts. Like, unless you happen to be on the trail during the what we call the bubble, which is when the largest amount of the thru hikers are on the trail in Southern California, which is, late spring basically, or early, early to late spring. It's amazing. I've gone on trips for long weekends where I didn't see anybody the whole weekend on the PCT, which everybody talks about, like how crowded the PCT is. I'm like, it's only crowded if you're in that bubble during that very small amount of time each year.
I get surprised because I'm very passionate about the PCT. It's like I have these big goals and dreams about the PCT. And as a runner, and this is something I want to encourage, if you're in Southern California, if you were looking for long and some nice runnable trails, it's because there's some sections where it's nice, like it's nice and maintained. For some most sections, there's some section where it gets. I was in behind San Gregorio area and I was like, oh my God, it's a little unmaintained area. But for the most part, there are areas where it's really maintained. Like plan your long runs. And if you go with someone, like you did the shuttle, you can leave one car in one end of your point and you leave another car at or your starting line and you can technically go forever. You can do a 20-mile run, a 30-mile run, a 40, you can do a 50-mile run, you can do a
Oh, I see
100-mile run.
you have the Leona Divide shirt on, right? And there's
Yeah,
a classic
exactly.
trail run that happens on the PCT.
There's a lot of, so there's a, I want to encourage more runners to run on the PCT to give back to the trail with the association, the Pacific Crest Trail Association to just help and support because I think it's a true gift living here in California, how we're with, even within LA, you're at least an hour drive to any points of the PCT. Vasquez Rock, such a gorgeous area. For you, what do you think is an underrated area in Southern California that you're like, wow, I can't believe like nobody knows. Well, I guess now people are gonna know, but like
Good. No, people should
I
know.
want people to explore more.
Well, there's two areas that surprised me the most. One was the Sierra Pelona, so which the Leona Divide goes through part of that. Like, that's the area when you get you cross over the 14, and it's bef like between the 14 in the mountains going toward Palmdale. And in the springtime, the whole north side of those mountains gets the rain shadow. And so it's got oak trees and pine trees in some areas. Miner's lettuce grows in there. It's very green. You can eat it, tastes like spinach. That area was a total revelation to me. And then a little further north, so just north of Lake Tehachapi, is the Paiute and Scodie Mountains. So a lot of people. So that's basically the foothills of the Sierra, even though people think the Sierra doesn't start till Kennedy Meadows, which is like 200 miles later. It's, or maybe 100 miles later. But those foothills are beautiful, especially in like March when the wildflowers are out. So I remember climbing up from Tehachapi Pass from Highway 58 on the trail and getting to the top of the mountain, and there was just a carpet of wildflowers up there. It was amazing. And the views were stunning, and it was just quiet. Like, when you do get deeper in those mountains, there are definitely some OHV users that cross through the area, so it won't feel as remote. It may not be as quiet, but those lower parts are just so pretty. So many oaks, which, a lot of our oaks were taken out when the Spanish missionaries came in and like decimated everything. Those are some of the areas where you can still see some of the oak trees that used to be everywhere in Southern California.
Was there any point in the Sierra where you were just like, wow, this is like it just blew your mind? Because you spend so much time in the Sierra that you knew a lot of it. I'm sure you already knew a lot of it, but was there any section where it really kind of like you were just surprised?
There was the one The one area that I hadn't been to yet, or one of the very few areas in the High Sierra, is the area around Evolution Basin. And I'd always heard amazing things about it. And the funny thing is, like, I had built this area up in my mind so much. I was like, this is gonna be so cool. I was like deep into a 9-day stretch because I think I'd resupplied in Kearsarge, over Kearsarge Pass and Independence. And then I was doing a slow boat to like Vermilion Valley Resort. So 9 days is a lot of food to carry. But I was so excited. And then I got up there to the pass and it was wonderful, but I was also super hangry. And I did not eat properly. So this goes back to what I said earlier. Sometimes you just need to sit down and have a snack because, man, I was like, I don't know if I'm long for this world. I hate everything. And I laugh because when I look back at my pictures from that area, it's stunning. And I went back there last summer to sort of have a do-over with food in my system. But I still, like, even through being undernourished and like a little hangry, remember thinking just how vast it felt up there and how beautiful. The funny thing is, last summer when I was up there, somebody was at the summit hut at 7 a.m. when we got there who knew me and had my book. So I was like, oh wow, making new memories up here.
Yeah, and this is a great book for those, like, there's amazing pictures here and some maps, like nice, see, you get some maps, some images, you have like bullet points, and in the back you have for like when you drop your, what's it called, when you drop for caching places.
Oh, like resupplying. Yeah,
resupply. You know, there was this like, and there's like services and resources, so highly recommend this book. Where can they buy it if they want to? I got mine at REI. But where other places can they buy this book?
I always recommend, because I'm a total book nerd who still likes to hold physical books, like going to your local indie shop. A lot of the ones in Southern California do carry it. Like Romans is the one closest by me and they carry it, Skylight, stuff like that, or ordering it from your indie shop. You know, you can get it directly from the publisher, which is Mountaineers Books, but yeah, I'm a big supporter of, like, anytime I see a bookstore, I go in and try to buy a book. So whatever you could do to keep the indie stores alive, that's rad. Mm-hmm. Or a lot, like, I love the visitor centers in the Sierra all seem to have it in stock. Sometimes I'll go sign them when I'm there, which is fun.
Next time we meet, I'm going to bring the book so you can sign it. Well, is there a memorable point when you were, like, out in the PCT and you knew you were writing this book where you were, like, in shock that you're like, oh my God, like my dreams of being a writer and actually doing this full time, because you quit your job, your full-time job, to kind of, you took this risk. And was there any point in PCT where you just kind of like, I don't know, like it was like an aha moment for you?
Yes. I will say, it's funny because I didn't quit my job till after, like, I took a leave, like a sabbatical basically for a couple months. And then after, while I was out there one night, I was camped at the Woods Creek Suspension Bridge. If you've hiked on the Numupoyo, otherwise known as the John Muir Trail or the PCT or the Ray Lakes Loop, like anywhere in that area, you know this bridge because it's like skinny, long, kind of sways back and forth when you're on it. It's a pretty cool bridge. Very memorable location. And I had come that day from having an encounter with a bear. When I turned a corner, there was a blonde black bear. So it looked kind of like someone had dipped it in a bucket of bleach. And it, I turned the corner, I saw it, it saw me. We could have high-fived, we were that close. And it was, I think the bear might've been a little more scared than I was, but you know, it's like a startling situation. And so my adrenaline was just raging that day. And I got to Woods Creek and there was this girl that I'd been leapfrogging with all day named Kat. And she's one of my closest friends now, actually. And she's like, can I camp with you? I'm like, yes. And I wasn't even going to camp there that night, but I ended up doing it anyway. And I remember that night, like, our tents flooded. There was so much rain, probably like these storm systems that just came through. Our tents flooded. I've never had that happen before or since. But I remember that night at some point looking at the sky when it was clear and not raining and thinking like, wow, I can't believe I'm here right now. I can't believe I'm here writing a book. This is the dream I've had since I was a little kid. And I would be just a dummy if I didn't try to make something out of this. And that was the day I decided to quit my job. And I remember telling my boss, Michael, when I got back, and Michael's like family to me. I actually ended up, when the pandemic hit, started taking some of my clients back. Mm-hmm. So I think a mix of music and writing work now, but I remember telling him, and he's like, I kind of figured this was coming. So that's what happens when you go out on the trail for a couple months. It changes your life, you know.
And how do you use this nature time? I know you talked a little bit like walking meditation, some more of your mental health. Like, how do you incorporate nature time, or what does it mean to you to be out in nature? Like, how has that helped your overall mental health?
It's everything. I mean, when you think, sometimes it's really easy, I think, to get bogged down in the news, this constant barrage of information, a lot of it really negative and harmful and hurtful and worrisome, right? You know, you think about things that are going on and you're like, man, what is the future going to look like? And being out in nature grounds me. It centers me in right now, right here. It reminds me that all of this stuff around us is kind of made up. I mean, people decided on these systems long before we were born. They were created, they've been upheld. So much of this is just stuff we kind of accept. Does that mean it's reality? Does that mean it has to always be like this? No. And being in nature sort of reminds me of that. It reminds me that I am a part of nature. I'm not the separate thing that has to be in this world of concrete and glass. You know, I also get to be out there. This is also my home. And so it's just a really grounding experience for me. You know, it's also just a hell of a lot of fun to be out there. And, you know, sometimes it's to push my body, you know, like when I go running, sometimes I do it for that. Or if I go on a long hike or try to, you know, accomplish some big goal, sometimes it's meditative. Sometimes it's spiritual. Sometimes it's a way to be with other people or a way to be completely by myself. And, you know, I feel really grateful that I can have all of those relationships and all of those things come out of my time outside. Mm-hmm. And that's why I try to maximize it. Like, I go on walks in my neighborhood and I can still kind of call up some of those same feelings as long as I remind myself, like, hey, that, you know, this is nature too. There's nature here. It's everywhere. So.
And what advice or what words would you want to share with, there's women out there who want to spend more time in nature, either through trail running, backpacking, or hiking, but they fear of seeing that bear or that bobcat. They fear just being out in wild by themselves. Like, what would you like to let them know to kind of get them encouragement to not fear the wild?
I think that there's a lot of things that we can fear in life, you know, whether it's out in nature or here in cities. And when we let those things dictate our actions, that fear wins. And what you could do is just think about the things you're afraid of and think about them logically. Like, okay, if you're going backpacking, you're worried, like, I'm going to be cold, I'm not going to sleep at night. You know, for the most part, you're probably going to be okay as long as you have a decent sleeping bag and some clothes. It could be an uncomfortable night, but you know what? You're going to wake up in the morning, or maybe you will have been up all night. And so what? It's a story you learn from it. Everything, like I talk a lot about how everything I feared going solo backpacking has happened. I feared having bear encounters. I feared lightning. Like, I had lightning strike the ridge next to me when I was going over Glen Pass. I feared like getting stuck in a snowstorm, like all these different things that I worried about. And they've all happened to different degrees, and I've been fine every single time. You know, I went out there with some knowledge and know-how, and I think that's the best thing you can pack is like your brain. and so, you know, being a constant student of life and being a constant student of these things that you're interested in helps sort of tamper down some of those fears. When you learn about bears, you realize like, oh, okay, here in California, all we have are black bears. We don't have grizzlies. There are like very specific things you can do to sort of deal with bears, right? So you can protect your food. You can, you know, make a little noise maybe when you're hiking. Although I always joke that the bear bells are just dinner bells for the bears, but so maybe don't use a bear bell, but no, it's a joke. But you know, there's ways, just like anything in life. Like, you want to learn how to ride a bike, but you're afraid of falling, you fall a few times. Like, you'll realize, just like trail running, I was so scared of falling. I biffed it on like my very first mountainous trail run. I biffed so hard. I still have a scar to this day on my knee, but I got up and I laughed and I was like, okay, that happened. I'm fine. So you know, sometimes just get out there and do it. And if you're really nervous about doing it by yourself, there's so many ways to get out there with other people. You know, whether it's a class like the Wilderness Travel Course, a group like what you guys do out on the trails with Trail Chicas, you know, there's a lot of ways to sort of let your joy take over instead of letting your fear take over.
Mm-hmm. And there's another thing, like backpacking or being out in the wild for multiple days. And as a woman, like, having your period, is there any tips or things that you has helped you? And I want to talk about, because this is primarily for women podcast, and it does happen. And when you're ultra running, you're out on the trail sometimes, you know, for long periods of time, and sometimes your training has to happen when you're in your period. And backpacking, you're out there in days, you know, in this case, you're out there for 2 months. So I'm sure it happened at one point. What has helped you? What has kind of, I'm sure you kind of have a system by now. So many times, someone mentioned poop. So we could talk a little bit about that. Pooping stories are always fun.
Pooping stories are great. I mean, I talk about poop all the time, but yeah, period stuff. Like if you're a person who has a period, there's so many different ways that, you know, whatever you work at home, you could probably get to work out there, except for, I will say, like running in the desert is a whole nother animal because you don't have a lot of water access. Mm-hmm. So like if you use, so I use a Diva cup or something similar to that. It gets hard in the desert where you don't really have great places to rinse off. So I just switched to, the little OB tampons that don't have the applicator, that way you're not carrying around a bunch of like plastic with you and a bunch of garbage. To me, it's a little easier. And you just, like, a lot of people are squeamish, and I get it, because we're taught to be squeamish about our bodies. Like women are taught, like, we don't talk about that. That's gross. And it's not, it's just part of your body's function. If you're a person who has a period, that's just part of your body's function, and it's A-okay. So learning to get comfortable with, like, oh, okay, maybe I'll bring some, you know, normally I don't carry wipes, but when I have my period, I'll carry some wipes, because it's just that extra bit to help you clean up, and, you know, bring a little baggie to put it in. It's all manageable. And I, you know, I run all the time. So running and backpacking while with my period is very normal to me at this point.
So kind of like you mentioned before, just do it once.
Just do it. Do it once.
Yourself, you'll learn. You'll know what you missed. You didn't know. You'll be like, oh, okay. I just got a little stain. It's fine.
So many of the things we worry about or that we fear are honestly other people's worries and fears, or things that other people want us to feel. Like, you know, maybe you have a parent or a partner or somebody who is like, oh my gosh, don't go run alone, or don't go backpack alone. That's scary. You're going to get hurt. You're going to get murdered. That's their fear. You know, it's because it's something that's unknown to them. You know, but you don't have to carry other people's fears out there. Other people's like squeamishness about poop or pee or periods or whatever, you know, it happens to a lot of us, and it's just normal parts of our bodies. So.
Yeah. You're going to poop. If you're doing 10, 8, even 2 hours or 3 hours, you never know. Cause when you got to go, you got to go. So just get comfortable. What has helped you get comfortable with pooping out in nature?
It goes back to just realizing I'm part of it all, man. Like, also pooping in nature. So in the West, we have toilets, you know, it's something that most of us have at home. And then you squat on the ground and you're like, oh, this is how people do it in a lot of other places. They just squat and they have, you know, sort of a whole situation in the ground. And it's like, oh, this is like dynamically aerodynamic way for the poo to exit the body. This is actually easier. I also just wait till I really have to go. I mean, you wait till the turtle head is like, hey guys. And that way too, it lessens the poo anxiety. I also don't dig my hole till afterwards because I don't like to. So I make sure that I have a stick or something to push it in there, and I let myself relax and enjoy the view.
Because when you're like, if you gotta go, and you're like digging your hole, you're getting like, you're just like, I'm gonna shit on my pants.
Yes, I don't need that anxiety. Whatever I can do to make life easier that's where I'm at. So I do not pre-dig my cat holes, let it be known.
Yeah, that's actually a good tip, not to just do the deed and then you put your pants on and then you'll feel less. You don't even have to worry about anybody's going to come. You already did the deed. So now you can dig your hole calmly. You make sure it's 7 inches deep. You know, you put it in there and then you're like, all right, nothing happened here. I was just burying a little something.
Don't worry about me. I'm just digging for treasures.
Exactly.
Just don't be the person who just poops and then puts a rock over it, because not only is that disgusting when you turn over the rock, but it also means the poop takes so much longer to disintegrate because it's not getting, you know, moisture. Like, you need to put the poop in the soil and just let, because we don't get a lot of rain here, like, just let the soil do its job, let the sun do its job. Don't just leave little turd parties hanging out under rocks.
Is there anything you wish more people knew about the outdoors and how it can really help them that you would like to share?
I would just say, go back to that idea that this does not have to be a thing that's separate from us. It is us. We belong outside just as much as we belong inside a building or a house or whatever. Like, this is out there for everybody, and we all find our different ways to it. So whether it's trail running, backpacking, maybe you're into night sky, you know, astronomy, You like to go to the beach and surf, whatever your deal is, you have picnics with your family in the park. Like, there are ways for all of us to get outside, and you don't need to let somebody else's preconceived notions of what it means to be outdoorsy or an outdoor athlete decide what you do. Like, you decide what you do. You get to make that relationship yourself and decide what it is. So I think that if everybody can just remember, like, it doesn't need to feel like you're going to an alien planet. It's the outside is also you.
Oh, thank you so much, Shante. I really enjoyed it. I can't believe the hour's up already, but I know. I do want to encourage everyone to make sure, if you're interested in PCT, to check out Shante's book, Hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. It's Southern California. I know most of my listeners are from California. And if you're interested in through hiking California, they have different sections, and this is the Southern California. But like you say, it also covers Central California section. There's a lot of images, maps, detail information, a lot of resource there. So I highly recommend getting her book. Thank you again so much, Shante, for joining me today. If you're listening, if you missed late of the podcast and you joined later if you join later in the live today, you can rewatch it through Apple, Spotify, any of your favorite platforms, Anchor, or you can rewatch the whole video in our IG. So I'll save it there. And then if you have any questions, you always, you know, feel free to shoot it, Shante, in a DM. Is that okay?
Absolutely. unless you're sending me weird things. But yeah, no, yeah. Absolutely. Feel free to drop me a line, and I'm happy to talk.
Thank you so much, Shante. Thank you, everyone who joined us today. I really enjoy speaking with you, and I can't wait to see what your next adventures are ahead. And we do need to get a trail run in together. So we're going to plan that soon, because I need a signature too. So I'll make that excuse of why we got to see each other. No, we got to get a run in.
Perfect. I love it. Thank you so much for having me, and have an excellent rest of your day.
Thank you too. Bye, everyone.
Bye.